पुत्रं करने दिश्रयाम सेवा भद्रं पश्ये माक्षतेर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूपिः क्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृत्तश्वपाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
It was a new section. This verse of the section. Dva suparna sahija sakaya. Dva suparna sahija sakaya. Samanam vriksham parishasva jate. Samanam vriksham parishasva jate. Tayoranyatipalam. Swadvati Tayoranyapipalam Swadvati Anashnananyo Abhichakashiti Anashnananyo Abhichakashiti. Dwa Suparna Sayuja Sakaya Samanam Vriksham Parisha Swajate Tayoho Anyaha Pipalam Swadu Atti. Swadu, see the feather? Swadu Atti. Anashnan Anyo. Double na there, that's a sandhi. Anashnan Anyo. Abhichakashiti.
A lot of nuns in your house. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
In this section, the punishments will work like this. They'll give several different prakriyas, methods of unfolding the vastu. The vastu means Brahman. That which really is the truth of everything, that's the vastu. That which can no longer, that which has no parts, can't be divided, which actually exists, is the vastu. And so the Upanishad generally will use several methodologies for unfolding the vastu as yourself as Brahman. And it will also use different sadhanas, different types of meditative sadhanas for helping the mind to own up that vastu. Like, for instance, in the previous section, they use the meditation on Om, likening the Om to an arrow, like the bow and arrow meditation. And those are those are methodologies for helping the mind to recognize the self. In other words, when the self is being unfolded, and say the student doesn't quite understand, doesn't quite get it in the unfoldment, then you could go to meditative techniques to guide the mind to that recognition, or to guide the mind into a pattern of owning up. That's what Nididhyasana is about, really. It's a pattern, it's a meditative pattern that helps you, the ahankara, to own up the nature of the self that's been recognized at the time of teaching. That's one big difference between Nididhyasana and maybe meditative techniques that you may have learned outside of Vedanta. Because with Vedanta, the meditation, Nididhyasana, is used to own up what you recognize at the time of teaching. It's not used to generate an experience for you. Right? So that's a huge difference, actually. So here, if we use, with the use of the Omkara, the meaning of the word of Om has been taught. The meaning of yourself as Brahman has been taught. And so now it's giving a device, a methodology to have the mind just resolve into the self rather than the mind being running around here, running around there, it gives it a device to resolve into the self. So there are many such techniques, meditative techniques, to help the mind sit with the self that's been recognized at this time of teaching. In this section now, we're going to go into yet another methodology to help the student recognize the nature of yourself. And then it's also going to go into a system, the different values that are necessary, karma yoga, the different values that are necessary for the mind to have in order to be able to hold this knowledge. That's different than meditation. It really has to do with dharma, karma yoga, living a religious life. But what they mean by religious life is going to be defined. Right, so all of these values now are going to be unfolded. And like I was saying in the Thursday class, for those that were here, the values, all of the values, like ahimsa, non-injury, or non-boastfulness, all of these values are something which are natural for somebody who has self-knowledge. Right? But they're practiced by a mumukshu. What is natural to knowledge, which is just a natural effect of one who has self-knowledge, becomes a sadhana for one who does not yet have self-knowledge, mumukshu. So these values are practiced, and these values that are practiced become something very natural for one who has knowledge. But the practice of the values is important, because the practice of dharma, or the practice of proper attitudes, gives the mind a relative shanti, which allows this knowledge to take place. In other words, this knowledge can't reach a mind that is roaming around all over. Because the knowledge is taking place through the use of words, and so the mind has to be there, available to hear those words. And so the mind that is lost in this agitation or that agitation, or preoccupied with this or preoccupied with that, will only get little broken sentences coming in. Because the only thing the mind will get is what is being said when it is present. Right? So even though all our physical bodies are present right now, how present is your mind? What percentage of time has your mind been here in the last 10 minutes? And so say it's been here 50% of the time, the rest of the time it's been daydreaming. Well, it's heard 50%. That's what it's heard then, 50%. What's interesting when you really think about it is the mind, when it's daydreaming, it'll daydream, come back, daydream, come back, daydream, and come back. And so what are you actually hearing? See, I'm talking. And then it's that. But I am dying. See what I mean? So, a lot of that agitation or distraction, just for a person who has the sadhana chatushtya, you know, that has the viveka and vairagya, a lot of that distraction drops off naturally just by viveka and vairagya. You know? But then there are also attitudes and whatnot that we can be weak in, that causes a lot of agitation and worry and hurt and distraction in the mind. And so these values become very important, just because they give the mind a sense of shanti that allows it to be able to sit in one place. It's very simple. When we talk about antakarna shuddhi, or you have to have antakarna shuddhi in order to gain this knowledge. Antakarna shuddhi means purity of mind. You have to be pure. You have to have purity of mind to gain this. I used to think that meant, when I was young, having read Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi, their idea of purity of mind was almost that you had to be walking around in a subtle body, that you were so pure. You were so pure that your feet barely touched the earth. And I used to really be concerned about that, because I could not have, I didn't think that would be a possibility for me, which I still don't think that was a possibility. You know, so these words, for some of us, these words like antakarna shuddhi, purity of mind, you know, have become blown up out of proportion, or you can even attribute it to your notion of saintliness. If you have a pure mind, you are a saint. And then God knows what saint means. That's another word. Another word can be blown up way out of proportion. But here, this antikarana shuddhi really means a mind that has enough shanti, that has some shanti, some stability and some peace that will allow it to gain this knowledge. So it's a very practical, very simple idea. Dharma is also practical and simple. You know, but to really be able to practice Dharma completely, wholly, you know, one has to recognize oneself, because otherwise you're asking yourself to do what in some ways is not really feasible, to for you to always be self-sacrificing. Right? It's easy that we practice Dharma as much as possible, but sometimes when I want something very badly, you know, I make little compromises because I want it so badly. And I want it so badly because I think that will make me happy. It's like I need this in order to be happy. When I need it badly enough, I'll make compromises. You know, everybody does. In some way or another, we're not perfect. And so those compromises are agitating, right? But so to have relative dharma, to have a value for the values, Swamiji's written that book, Value for Values. To have a value for the values so that my mind has a value for practicing those values, because I know what I get from it. I know what the reward is. For a jnani, those values are natural because I'm not seeking to become happy. And I'm not seeking to become whole or complete or to please myself. That search is over. When that search is over, then I don't feel like I'm self-sacrificing. I'm just doing what is normal to be done in the situation. It's so important to understand what you do when you are not in the grip of a desire, then your behavior is saintly. When you're not in the grip of a desire, because then what is best for the situation, what is best for the people, is the natural thing for you to do. It's when you're in the grip of a desire that things become distorted and twisted. And so for a jnani, for a person who's not in the grip of the desire, that behavior is much more objective, rational. You know. The understanding behind this is that every human being, Ishwara, is good. The nature of the self, of the Atma, is Ananda, is full and whole and complete, and that is the core of every being, right? That one self, which is pure and whole and complete. You know, that is yourself, right? And so in the mind, if the mind that's having a problem, the mind gets confused and has projected yourself out there and then runs trying to find it, trying to get a hold of yourself, you know, that you think is out there, and gets itself all tangled into all kinds of problems. And so we have to relatively untangle. We have to relatively untangle the mind and give it some values and some understanding so it can have some shanti, so that it is in a position to gain this knowledge, because this knowledge takes place through the use of words. It has to take place through words, because yourself is not an object of perception. Your being is not out here to look at or to experience. You can't experience yourself any more than it's already experienced. So there's nothing you can do to gain it. There's nothing you can do to generate the experience. You can't see yourself through your five sense organs. And so there's some ignorance that the mind is suffering from, and that ignorance has to be removed. How is it going to be removed? And that exactly is what the Vedanta, what the Upanishads are. They're pramana, through the use of words, to point the mind, to make the mind see what is there, to see what it can't see through the sense organs. To do that, the mind has to be available, right? Because words take place one at a time. And so the mind, the words are painting a picture. They're setting the mind in a direction. And so the mind has to be available to be able to hook onto those words and follow the direction, because the words are pointing to make you see something, to make you recognize something, to make you see something that's there. But if the mind's not available, it's distracted, then those words can't do their job. And so the Dharma and these values are simply meant to give the mind enough relative shanti, right? So that the mind can hold the sea and hold this knowledge. See what it is? And so now, and this is true for all the Upanishads, there will be a section. There'll be a section that's going to deal with these values. Now they're called external bahiranga sadhanas. External sadhanas just means that it has to do with attitudes. So here he starts out though, so that's kind of an introduction to this section. So he starts out giving a mantra. Shankara says this mantra is kind of in the form of a sutra. It means it's a very, very brief. And then he's going to spend a few verses unfolding the truth of this mantra. So it says, Dwa Suparna Sayuja Sakaya. All of these for Sanskrit students, all of these long ah endings, you have to replace that it's Vedic, and they're actually in the dual. So in classical Sanskrit, it would be like Dwau Ramaha Ramau, Dwau Suparnau Sayujau Sakayau. So Dwau Suparnau, two birds, right? Dwau means two. Suparna, I'll keep the Suparna, no, it's dual, okay? So Dwa Suparna, two beings with beautiful wings. Parnas are wings. Su stands for they're beautiful, beautiful wings. So two beautiful winged birds, shining, with shining wings, that means they're conscious beings. Two conscious birds, Dwa Suparna, Sayuja, they are joined together. They can't be separated. They can't be one that's dependent on each other. One can't be apart from the other. So these two beautiful birds, which are Sayuja, they're united together. Sakaya, and great friends. They're great friends. We'll see why that is in a minute. So these two birds that are united together, associated together, which are their great friends. Samanam Vriksham. Vriksham, the same tree, samanam vriksha, samanam means the same, vriksham, on the same tree, parisha swajate, they're clinging, both of them, they're clinging to the same tree. So these two birds, which have beautiful wings, shining wings, that are associated together, and good friends, they're clinging to the same tree, samanam vriksha, vriksha means tree. To yoho, of these two, of the two birds, Anyaha, the one, Pipalam Swadu Ati. Ati means to eat. Pipalam Ati. It eats fruits. The Pipalam. Pipalam is a fruit. It will eat the fruit, which is Swadu. Swadu means it has many tastes. The one bird is eating fruits, and these fruits have many tastes. Some are bitter, some are sweet, some are sour. You know, some are pungent, some are rotten, in all different types of tastes. So the one bird is eating fruit that has all of these various swadhu, all of the various tastes. And then, anushnan anyaha, the other is anushnan, it's not eating. Ashnan means eating. Anushnan, the unnegates. Anushnan, okay? Anushnan anyaha, the other, not eating. The other, not eating, abhicha kashiti. It simply shines. It shines. Right? It shines as consciousness. Right? Just simply illumines. It's not performing any activity at all. The root here is chakas. Chakas, it just means to illumine, to shine of itself. Okay? So where the abhi means all around, without doing anything, it just simply shines, completely shines of itself. Okay, so now, what is this? Shankara has a nice bhasha on this also, which I've read, so I'll just kind of repeat it. Swamiji also talks about it in his commentary. The vriksha is a symbol for the body. And in fact, in Shankara's Bhasha, he talks about the Ashwatha tree, which is a vriksha. And in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 15, they talk about the Ashwatha tree that has its roots above and its branches below. The roots above means not visible. The roots above stand for Brahman. So the tree, the vriksha, has for its roots Brahman. And the trunk and the tree itself are the samsara. And it's this vriksha now, in reference to this verse, is being likened to the sharira, the subtle body and the physical body. The vriksha is the body of the individual. So here this body, which is rooted in the Atman, this body itself is something which, the vriksha, is something which can be filled. But there's two ways it can be filled. It can be filled only to grow again, because the jiva takes birth after birth after birth after birth. So one type of filling, that's the endless filling, right? You get rid of this, but because the roots are not destroyed, right? But then there's the type of filling where the vriksha is pulled out from its roots. It means all of the ajnana that had caused the vriksha to flourish is also removed. Okay? So if we look at the vriksha as this physical body with the linga, with a subtle body also. On this vriksha, there are two birds. Right? In this body, there are two birds. One bird, right, is enjoying the results of samsara, of karmapala. Right? The pipalam is the karma. So the one bird is eating, means enjoying, all of the fruits of their karma. So that bird has kartatvam and bhoktatvam. I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I'm experiencing this, I'm experiencing that, I'm enjoying that, I'm suffering from this. So the one bird has sukha and dukkha, right? Those are the swadhu. The swadhu means the taste. Because all of the karma polos, remember what they say, just in the tradition, that to take this physical body in this loka here, it's 50-50. You're exhausting your karma here. 50% of the karma is meant to give you pleasure. 50% is meant to give you pain. And so your life will give you a gamut, right? It'll give you a whole display of experiences, multifarious experiences, good and bad, every pleasure and pain, all different degrees of sukha, all different degrees of dukkha, agitation. So a person doesn't, you know, go through life as though it were Swargaloka here. So we don't experience it that way. So a person gains all kinds of results of their karma here, good and bad. And so here, all right. I'll bring out the blankets if you need it. So of these two birds that are best friends, united together, one is totally involved in karma, right, in the results of the action. The other bird just simply abides, simply shines, not eating anything, not at all involved in the karmapala. Right? So one is the jiva. One bird is the jiva. The other bird is Ishwara. So it's a... Netha Shankara deals with this. It doesn't say one bird is Atma, one bird is Brahman. One bird is the jiva. One bird is Ishwara. Because that's really the truth of it. So now, what's being said? Here in this body, right? In this body which can be filled, the ajnanam can be removed, right? The jiva is the product of ignorance. The jiva bird is the one who says, I am the doer, I am the enjoyer, right? So now, who is saying? You just, we have to look, really, what I want you to do is really look into your inner experience. There is a mind that says, I am the doer, I am the enjoyer. It means I am happy, I am sad, I am agitated, you know, I am sorrowful because I am in trouble because of this experience. So now that's the mind within ahankara. Ahankara means the I notion. Now look at what's happening. This is the jiva bird, okay? This is the jiva bird. The I am happy, it says. I am happy. That's a statement of mind. It's a statement of mind. Right? It's what we call ahankara. There's a happy thought in the mind, and the ahankara comes and says, I am happy. And so now, when you say, I am happy, that means that the I, the conscious being, is being identified with that state of mind. So the I and the state of mind become one and the same. Now say the mind is having a negative karmapala, right? It's eating of a negative fruit. And that negative fruit is creating dukkha. Now the ahankara says, I am sorrowful. So now what has happened is that this I am, which is the I thought, right, is now identifying the conscious being with the sorrowful thought. This is the ahankara. Now say the body becomes ill and it gets the flu. So now the body has the flu, another dukkha. Okay. Now the ahankara says, comes in and says, I have the flu. Right? It's serious. It's absolutely serious about this. I have the flu. Now the ahankara that has taken place in the mind is identifying me, my being, with the body, which is sick. Now say it says the flu is over. Now the ahankara says, ah, now I am well. But now this means that I was sick, now I am well. I was happy, now I am sad. See what I mean? So now, this is what we call the jiva bird. This is the bird that is eating of the fruits of the karmapala. Because the ahankara is identifying, right? The ahankara is identifying with the state of experience. And that creates a jiva. Right? A jiva's been created now. But who is the jiva? Really? The jiva, the ahankara comes and it says, I am. The I am that jiva is labeling, right? The I am that the jiva is labeling is the other bird. The I am that the jiva is labeling the self, that is the other bird that is sitting absolutely silently, not participating, not doing anything, just simply shining as simple being. It's just simple being, simple presence that is there. So now, that one is not participating at all. It's not eating of anything. So, but the jiva bird, and the jiva bird has no being apart from this self-shining one, right? Because the self-shining one is the I experience of the jiva bird. Right? So look at the jiva bird kind of as the mind with the ahankara. Because when the mind says, with the ahankara, the I notion says, I am, what is the I am experience that it's labeling? That is the other bird. That's Ishvara. The I am that it's labeling, that experience is Ishvara. And then it takes that experience, which is Ishvara, the changeless, shining self in this Maya Upadhi, right? It takes that and it identifies it with the experience in the individual mind. Right? And so that's how these two birds are both sitting in the same place. In fact, there's only one bird. Right? In fact, there's only one conscious being. But that conscious being is treated as two. Because you identify yourself as a jiva. You identify the consciousness that is Brahman, the consciousness that is Ishvara, right? That is the one consciousness which is the truth of the whole. you identify, the ahamkara comes and identifies that conscious being that you are with a condition of mind or a condition of body. Okay, so let's look at it here. In reality, that's why they say Jiva and Ishwara, because here we are in this creation. And so in this, from the vantage point of this creation, there is a conscious being. There's the Ishwara bird, right? The Ishwara bird, right, is the conscious being, which in fact is the self of all experience. It's the consciousness which the entire universe enjoys, right? It's the non-dual, non-objectifiable, changeless presence that is me, right? Which is really the consciousness that all of my experience enjoys. In this way, you can appreciate Ishwara just as this room. This room is enough. If you can appreciate Ishwara as this room, you can experience appreciate Ishwara as the entire universe. Right? See if I can do. You can appreciate Ishwara as the entire universe. It's this. Right now, and we did this a little bit in the meditation. In your experience at this moment, there is nothing in your experience that's away from consciousness, because the totality of your experience is known. Right? Like, if I look over across the room, this wall is known, and this rug is known, and you each are known. This wall is in my consciousness. This space is in my consciousness. You are in my consciousness. The rug is in my consciousness. This body is in my consciousness. My sense organs are in my consciousness. The mind is in my consciousness. There is absolutely nothing that's away from me as a conscious being. Everything's away from me, in a sense, as a body. If I take myself to be this body, that wall is 10 feet from me. You know, the rug is 2 feet from me. There's distance. I'm a limited being, different from you, from you, from you, from you. Right? But that's when there's that Dehatma Buddhi. That's identification with the body. That is the Jiva. That is the Jiva. Who tells me that I am this body? That the conscious being that I am is limited to this body? That the conscious being that I am is limited to this mind? Who tells me that? The mind does. Like my mind, which is indwelling this body, which is different from your mind, because of avivekā, because of ignorance, has taken the conscious being that I am, me, my own presence, and taken it to itself. And so then I become the jiva bird, right? But in fact, the jiva bird, the self of the jiva bird is Ishwara, right? So the jiva bird doesn't have any being apart from the self that's being that it itself is labeling as itself. Why we say the two birds, but there aren't two birds. There's two birds as though, because of ignorance. So for the jnani, the vision is very much different, because for the jnani, the one who has self-knowledge, what happens is that the jiva bird becomes mitya. Right? The jiva bird becomes apparent. As long as you have this upadhi, this body, mind, sense organs, right? As long as you have this living, it itself will reflect awareness. Right? It will reflect awareness. Reflect is an awkward word. Sorry. You might have to go into meditation soon. I'm having an allergy. Okay. Do you have any allergy?
Yeah.
Okay. let me try this again. The problem, the internal problem, is it's such a simple thing. If the ahankara, if the I notion, when your I thought, if it comes and it labels the self as being the mind, or the self as being a condition, that is the jiva. That's the creation of the jiva. There is no jiva really. There is only atma. There's only one self. So now, say, the ahankara, instead of labeling yourself as the condition you're experiencing, simply labels yourself. In other words, that ahankara, that mind, has knowledge. Right? The other one is suffering from aviveka. In either case, the self that you are, that is Brahman, is totally 100% present. It's not about having a new experience. It's about how whether the ahankara takes your being to be one, because of lack of discrimination. The ahankara takes your being to be one with the experience you're having, or it recognizes yourself and the experience. Right? It recognizes yourself and the experience, or it just recognizes yourself as the experience. You see the difference? You know, so that's why, just think about it. This is how obvious it is. If you're just sitting quietly and you're watching your thoughts, right? From one vantage point, and if you're not alert to it, you just are your thoughts. The focus of the mind simply is on the thoughts that are going through the mind. That's it. You're just simply aware of the thoughts. There's no other viveka. There's no discrimination there. Now, what about, so that's one condition. You're still very much there, and the thoughts are passing through. The whole focus of the mind is only on the thoughts, right? You'll talk, you'll say, I am having these thoughts, right? Or I am thinking, or I am sad, or I am thinking about this. You'll talk like that, but you won't recognize the reality of the fact that you are present to those thoughts, that there's a subject-object differentiation. That viveka is normally not made. Once that viveka is there, then what happens? Then the ahankara can label me as myself. I am me. I am the self, the Brahman, the conscious being. And the thoughts are the thoughts. The thoughts come and go. The moods come and go. The perceptions come and go. My being doesn't come and go. So this is night and day for a person who has self-ignorance. This reality is simply not there. There is not a stable self. That Ishwara bird is totally missed. But the Ishwara bird is the Jnani bird. It is the Ishwara bird is the Jiva bird. You see that? There is no Jiva bird. The Jiva bird is a product of ignorance. But in reality, there's no Jiva bird. So what is the Jiva bird? The Jiva bird is simply the one that says, I am sad, or I am doing this, or I have the flu. Right? That's the jiva. But is there a jiva in reality? Because the I that it's labeling, the conscious being that it's referring to, is Ishwara. So there is no real jiva bird. So now, look at this situation, if you just take this room. In fact, the entire room is in my being. The existence of this room and the knownness of the room comes from me. It doesn't come from anything else. Right? That's why if I can become alert to my experience, I see all of you are out here that I'm aware of through my sense organs. And then I recognize, well, I'm aware of this physical body through my sense organs too, so this physical body belongs to the room. It's also an object. But just think of it. You're all looking and you're seeing what you're seeing, but you're also perceiving your physical body. So your physical body is as much a part of this room and as a part of your experience as is everything else. It's not separate. Right? And so here, this physical body, which is part of Ishvara, is the jiva bird. But this jiva bird is not part of, is not separate from Ishvara. It's as much part of this whole as is everything else. But what makes it a jiva bird is that the mind, the subtle body, your mind says, I am this. There's the jiva bird. I am this. Where in fact, I am the changeless self in which the totality of experience takes place. I'm not doing anything. My mind is thinking, the sense organs are perceiving, the ahankara is very active, saying I'm doing this and I'm doing that and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. But all of these things belong to Ishvara. All these things belong to the creation. All these things are objectifiable. All of these things come and go. Right? In fact, in Shankara remarks in his Bhasha, the Ashwata tree, which is in the 15th chapter of the Gita, it means that which won't be here tomorrow. Ashwata means that which is always changing. So the tree of samsara that we experience is that which is always changing, always in flux. The ahankara also is always changing, always in flux. Half of it is. Half of the ahankara is always changing, in always in flux. Half of it is changeless. The half of it that's changeless is the I am. Right? But then the I am, me, is always being hooked on to different experiences. You know, that's the jiva bird. But the I am that the ahankara is enjoying is Brahman. There is no other Brahman. There is no other reality to be had. There are many infinite varieties of experience. Those are the swadhu ati. Pipalam swadhu ati. Swadhu ati means that those are the fruits that the jiva bird is eating. Any experience, whether it be a mental experience, a meditative experience, a physical experience, these are all the people and these are all the fruits that are being experienced in the samsara. Yeah. That's the jiva bird. The Ishvara bird is the conscious being that lights up all those experiences. And that conscious being is the truth of the whole thing. And that conscious being is me. The conscious being is not away from any experience that I have. That's why it's important just to, like when we did the meditation earlier, to recognize everything that you experience is known. And that known is the consciousness. Consciousness itself is self-lit. There's nothing lighting up your experience. In other words, let's put it this way. Everything is known. What makes it known? Because of what is everything known? Because say when you're doing say meditation, it's easy to say, okay, everything that I'm experiencing, all of that is known. Even myself is known. What's making the self known? What's lighting up the self? The mind is lit up, the sense organs are lit up, the perceptions are lit up. What lights up the self? I am lit up. Because I am here, I am known. So there is nothing away from that experience. That experience of being known, or that experience of consciousness. Nothing is lighting it up, nothing's behind it, nothing's in front of it. It is its own experience. And you are never at any time away from that experience. You are, in fact, that experience. Not by experience, not as a subject-object experience, but as the very conscious being that you are. And so now, how are you going to have that experience? You can't have that experience. You already are that experience. You can't have a self-experience more than the experience that's already there. We're always trying to seek to have an experience so that we can become enlightened. So that we can have an enlightenment experience or have a meditative experience. But if you're having a meditative experience, then what happens when that meditative experience goes? Any experience that comes and goes is the swadhu. Right? That's the flavor. That's the taste. That is just an experience. So you need to recognize the experience that doesn't come and go. And that's yourself. It's there all of the time, no matter what experience that you're having. That is the common denominator of all experience. And that is you. So now when you say, well, me, what do I mean by me? What do I mean by me? Well, now this is one thing where meditation is useful, because you are the one that you can't get rid of. So you ask yourself, okay, who here is me? What is the core experience of myself, the conscious being that I am? What is the core presence? What is the core being here that no matter what I do, I can't get rid of? When I meditate, when I make my mind really quiet and I get rid of all distractions, what is left? What can't I get rid of? Then you can ask yourself questions like, okay, what is me here? What is most me here? Say, well, this feels like me. This feels like me here. And you say, okay, this feels like who I am. All right, that's good. And you say, okay, can I cover it? Can I get rid of it? Can I change it? Can I make this me, can I shift it around? Can I make it more me or less me? And if you can't change it and if you can't get rid of it, then yeah, that's you. Then you can walk around and say, am I still there? Am I still there? Say, yes, I'm still there. And you notice, I'm always here. I'm never not here. You mean that's Brahman? Yes, that is Brahman. That is Brahman. It's not something that you can objectify. You're not something you can objectify. You can't put a bag over yourself. If you put a bag over yourself, if you put a bag over your head, you're still in there, right? You're still illumining the bag now. And so no matter what the mood is or what the perception is, you are still very much there. There's nothing you can do about it. And so then you recognize this me is not an object. And what happens, what changes when it's not an object that comes and goes. So once the ahankara, once the mind recognizes that ajnana is removed, then the ahankara identifies with the Ishwara, the bird. Then I can say aham brahmasmi. I am Brahman. What does that mean? Not that I've had a big Brahman experience. That I've recognized that my being, this me, is Brahman. It's not having a Brahman experience. It's recognizing that this me is Brahman. That this is that the Jiva bird is the Ishwara bird. Right? That the Jiva bird resolves into the Ishwara bird. Right? And so then this sense of kartritvam and bhoktritvam, this doership, all of these things become mithya, because as long as you have the body, mind, sense organs alive, it will be there. Your mind will be thinking, your body will be functioning, your sense organs will be perceiving, you'll be having moods and all of these things. But the ahankara doesn't identify. It doesn't say, I am this. It can never do that. You might tell somebody, oh, you know, I'm sick with the flu. Say Jnani says, I'm sick, I have the flu. Do you think all of a sudden the ahankara now has forgotten who I am and has now become sick with the flu? It's just talking. So you don't talk like a weirdo. The body, which I'm not, becomes ill with the flu. And my mind, which I'm not, is thinking, you know. But in terms of self-identity, I am me. And I know who that me is. I know who that self is. So this is something, it's subtle, but it's so important. Because even when we say aham brahmasmi, we think that I am going to recognize, I am Brahman, the big Brahman. But it's not that. If you recognize that this I that you are is Brahman. See the difference? This me that I am is Brahman. Not that I have to have this me have a Brahman experience. I recognize that this me is Brahman. And part of that understanding, so you have to recognize this, that yourself is not an object in the creation to be big or large. Time and space come with the creation, right? That's why if I say, you know, imagine a meadow with trees and the sun and a few clouds in the beautiful blue sky with birds chirping and you're walking along. Now I've just given you an imagination that has time and space in it and activity, right? That time and space comes, it's part of the imagination. Yourself, the one from whom the imagination has come, doesn't have time or space. It's just pure being. That's when you think of your own me, your own presence. It's not big and it's not large. It's just you. Right? It's non-dual. Right? So the imagination along with the space comes from you, and when you have that imagination, the whole imagination enjoys your being. Right? The being that it enjoys is you. And so like that, if you think this is one big imagination of which this body and mind and sense organs are a part, right? This whole thing, none of it is separate from you. And that is your experience. It's not separate from you. What makes you feel that it's separate is this dehatma buddhi, this identification with the body. But if you give this body to Ishvara, you give your mind and your sense organs to Ishvara, then your own presence, none of this is away from your presence, right? And so the seer and the seen are both part of Ishvara. Right? What do I mean by that? Your body sitting here, which is seeing and thinking, so the subject, aware of this object, both the subject and object belong to the creation. Right? The subject and the object, the seer and the seen. This body, mind, sense organs, is illumined by awareness. It is illumined by awareness, as well as everything that's perceived by this body, mind, sense organs. It is also illumined by awareness. See that? So the subject and object are both equally in awareness. Awareness itself is not doing anything. I just simply am. That's this chakasha siti. You know, it's just simply shining. I simply am the conscious being that I am. You know? When you're sitting in meditation, meditation is good because it slows everything down. You just notice, am I doing anything? I'm whole and complete as I am, but am I doing anything? I simply am. And that amness is absolutely complete. It's the very being from which this whole universe springs. It couldn't be more complete. You know? But sometimes we think, well, to be complete, I have to do something. Well, see if you're doing anything. You see, you're not doing anything. And they say, well, is this me that's not doing anything, is that okay? Is it okay that I'm not doing anything? And you'll say, would I want it to be otherwise? Would I want to do something? And in fact, you're so whole and complete, the idea of doing something doesn't occur. It has nothing, doing something has nothing to do with you. Right? It's not who you are. But, of course, you do lots of things. Because this universe is a whole, this Maya Upadi that is a whole expression of you. But you don't do anything to have that expression. Just to understand a little bit so you can take this with you maybe. Do you think how when you have a thought or an imagination, there's lots of activity in the imagination, lots of doing, and it is infinite, it's beautiful, and whatever it is. But the one from whom the imagination comes, that one's not doing anything. Right? What are you doing? If you have an imagination, what are you doing? What is the awareful being doing from whom the imagination, the mind is doing something, there's a lot of activity going on. But the conscious being from whom that comes is stable and always the same. You have to notice that. Meditation, you know, that meditation is good to help you to recognize that. Okay. Let's stop there. So. No, allergic fit. Om Purnamada Purnamida Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. It's just acknowledging that Brahman is the whole Maya Upadhi. Yeah. The jiva is Ishvara, it's a perfume or something. I don't know what it is. It's hard to tell, you know, if you have even slight little perfume, some are fine with me and some that I become brain dead. Don't worry about it. It's just weird. Okay. So what did you ask? That's serious.
I asked about the second word being...
Oh, Ishwara. Oh yeah, okay. In understanding this knowledge, sometimes a person will think what the knowledge that you get of the Atma is Brahman. The self is Brahman. Right? But the jiva is part of Ishvara. Right? The jiva is part of Ishvara, which is true. Right? It means the body, mind, sense organs are part of the whole. So this is part of the whole. But the jiva, this is wrong what I'm saying, okay, so don't get confused. This is how people can think about it. The jiva is part of Ishvara, that's true. But then the identity is in the self. Means the self of the jiva is the self of Ishvara. The self of Ishvara is called Brahman, the self which is infinite. And therefore the knowledge is Atma is Brahman. Okay? So then what happens is that there can be a split in your mind for some people where they think, all right, I, the jiva, am not Ishvara. I am part of Ishvara. But on the level of Atma, I am Brahman. I am Ishvara on the level of the Atma. And therefore, when I die, and the jiva doesn't transmigrate anymore, then I'll be just left as Atma, as pure consciousness. Right? Not realizing that the pure conscious being, which is Atma, is Ishvara. Atma is Ishvara. Right? There is no Brahman separate from Ishvara. Brahman is Ishvara. And so when you recognize I am Brahman, you are also recognizing that I am Ishvara, because Brahman is Ishvara. But you're not recognizing that this body, mind, sense organs is Ishvara. The body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishvara, right? So it would be like this. And you might not, any of you have this problem, because I'm pounding away at it all the time, so maybe you don't have it. I had the problem at one time, and that's why I pound away at it, to make sure that you don't have that problem. But, okay, say like this. If you have an imagination, you have the imagination, you have a dream, you have the dream, you are the self of the whole dream. Right? That dream has no being apart from you, it is your dream. Okay? Now, in that dream, you take, there are many characters in the dream, and you're identified with one of the characters. That character is part of the dream. It's not the dream, it's part of the dream. Right? But the self of the character is the self of the whole dream. Right? And that self of the whole dream is the one from whom the whole dream is. So the self of the dream is Ishvara, is the Ishvara of the dream. Right? And so your self, who you are, is the self of this, of the whole. So you, in fact, are Ishvara, who you really are, the conscious being that you are Ishvara. And so now, here, in this creation, here we have this Maya Upadi, this infinite creation, and within this infinite creation is the individual, the Jiva bird. Right? Now, what is Ishvara? What is Ishvara's experience in this entire creation? For Ishvara, it's just a conscious being with no identification with a given thing. It's like, for instance, if you have a dream and you're not identified with anything in the dream, you're just identified with the sattva, actually. Sattva, rajas, and tamas. There's only identification is with the sattva, because there's just a reflection of consciousness, because the entire dream is known. Right? So if the entire dream is known, you're not identified with any given thing. That's Ishvara. The jiva is where it, in this whole manifestation, there's an identification with a given part. So that is the jiva. But the jiva is, there is no jiva really other than Ishvara, except for the ignorance of the jiva that causes the jiva to say, I am the jiva. Because the I am that it's referring to is the self, is the me, from whom the whole imagination has come. So a way to play with this, to kind of understand the whole Maya of the whole thing, is to let yourself have an imagination, you know, and then recognize the fact that you are the being and the conscious being of that imagination. You are the one because of whom that imagination is known. You are the existence of the imagination, the being of the imagination, the consciousness of the imagination. The whole imagination is an expression of your being. And it is and it is the self of everything in that imagination. Right? So there's nothing in the imagination that is not the conscious being that you are. Does everybody see that? But now, from the standpoint of the one who has imagination, there's sarvajñatvam, there's omniscience. Right? Sarvashaktitvam, the whole thing, all-powerful, omniscient, because the whole thing is you. Right? But from a character in the dream, there's no omniscience. It's what we call alpajñaha. It's limited. Alpa means little. Alpajñaha. The knowledge is limited. It's little. But even though the knowledge is limited and little for that little character within the dream, the being of that character is not limited and little. It is the being of the whole. Right? And that being of the whole is the one from whom the whole thing has come. So you, in fact, are Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishvara, but yourself is Ishvara. Right?
So does a Jnani know, like, that the material, that you are the material, that Brahman is the material? You know, they say it's the material.
Upadana karanam.
Yeah.
When we say upadana karanam, what we mean by that means material called the nitya upadana karanam. It's just the conscious being.
Right.
Is the upadana karanam. Now, to understand what that means, is that when you experience this creation, the stuff of the creation is consciousness existence. That's the common denominator for all your experience. The other thing is then you say, well, let's see if I can find another thing here other than that conscious existence. And you can't find it because every single thing that you experience comes into existence and goes out of existence and it's infinitely divisible. So you can't find a thing here. You can find infinite conglomerate, but you can't find any substance. However, everything that you do find enjoys exactly the same substance. Right? Whether you have this lamp as a, this lamp is a conglomerate, I can break this lamp down into little atoms, molecules, atoms, and quarks. Finally, you know, taking it apart. No matter how small, how into what little pieces I break this up into, those still exist. They're still known and they still exist. That being is the common denominator that you can never get away from. And that being is not an object. It's the very substance of, it's the very like a substratum or the very substance of all your experience.
When you're taking everything apart, it's like you're taking apart the nitya.
Yeah.
It's like a mitya.
It's mitya. I mean, mitya, you prove that it's mitya.
Yeah.
Because it's infinitely divisible. You can't find anything.
Right.
But the being which is always there, no matter how far apart you take it,
yeah,
it always is.
Yeah. So in a sense, in one sense, you can't take it apart because the being is always there.
You can't take the being apart.
Yeah.
You can take the mitya apart.
They're different orders.
They're different orders of reality.
Mm-hmm.
But the mitya doesn't have any substance apart from the being itself. Like, say if you imagine taking the pot from the clay, you can't. Because the pot is the clay. So try to take name and form away from existence. If you take it away from being, existence, then it has no being.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't. Right? It's totally dependent. And it's not like the name and form are over here and the being is here. The being is the very substance of the name and form. But where is that being? It's not an object. I am that being. You know? So.
What's the difference then between Brahman and Ishvara? Why do you use the differences?
You use the differences as a teaching to for the student. Because here we have to remember where we start from in gaining this knowledge. You come into the teaching as an individual, limited person, different from me, different from you, in this creation, as a part of, you're a part of this whole, right? That's where you start. And so what has to happen is that you have to recognize first that yourself, in fact, is in the Driktrisha, the seer-seen differentiation. You have to first recognize that the conscious being that you are is differentiated from this body, mind, sense organs. Okay. Once this conscious, that's what we call the Atma, once that's been differentiated, then this body, mind, sense organs, then belongs to Ishvara. Right? Do you see what I'm saying? So now it's given over to Ishvara. Now this conscious being becomes limitless. Right? Now it's not limited. It's not limited by the body or the mind or sense organs. So this conscious being now is what we call Brahman. Okay? So the Atma is Brahman. Brahman is the self of Ishvara. So now we recognize that we have to go back into dealing with this creation, how this creation is not separate from that limitless self. So the first thing that has to happen is yourself has to be released from this body, mind, sense organs, which is then given over to the whole, to Ishvara. And then you have to recognize, well, that makes this self limitless. Right? It's not no longer contained. Right? Then we have to see, then we have to go, well, what's the relationship of this self to this infinite creation? And then we see that this infinite creation, which we call Ishvara, the conscious being plus this infinite creation is not separate from Ishvara. Right? So it's a methodology. Right? Then you realize that I am Ishvara. But otherwise, you can't start there, because otherwise you would say, I, this jiva, am Ishvara? That's impossible. How can I be Ishvara? Right?
Yeah. The beauty of it all is the methodology explains everything, and it's not a cheap way out of saying that this is an illusion, that's it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, when you say that thoughts like come into existence and go out of existence,
yeah.
I remember you often say that non-existence does not exist. And what's coming into existence and going out of existence then?
Yeah.
If nothing can really ever really truly go out of existence.
Well, that's what we call mitya. We have two things. In terms of our experience, we have satyam, that which always is. And we have mitya, that which depends upon satyam. And so, if something comes in and out of existence, that thing has no independent reality to begin with. So let's start with the clay pot, and then you can see it in reference to the mind. If you have a lump of clay and you make it into a pot, the pot has now come into existence, right? And if you squeeze it, flatten it into a plate, the pot has now gone out of existence, right? So we would say that that pot which you've experienced is mitya. It has no real existence. It has a dependent reality on the clay. Because nothing can come from non-existence and go into non-existence. Because non-existence doesn't exist, so nothing can be born from it, right? And so here in this reality, there is the being doesn't come in, nothing comes into being and goes out of being. Being is stable. Consciousness is stable. It doesn't have a beginning or end. And so these things that come into being and go out of being that we experience, we say are mitya. They're totally dependent for their being, right, on that which is satyam, the existence itself. And what is this material that is responsible for these names and forms? We say that is maya. And the etymology of maya, the Vedantic etymology of maya, is yama iti maya. That which is not is maya. Means that which has no being, independent being of its own. And it can't have an independent being of its own because it comes and goes. Nothing can come out of non-existence. So what is the reality of it? The reality is in satyam, the being that it enjoys, and that never comes in and out of existence. In fact, you can break something apart into smaller and smaller parts, but all of those always are. It is, it is, it is. This part is now. This broken part pieces are now. These shards are now. The existence never varies at all. So that's the satyam nitya relationship, and we say that material that's responsible for this manifestation of names and forms in the form of this creation, which we call is what we call maya. It has no substance apart from the self. And what you have as an individual, you have that maya at your disposal in terms of your mind, your imagination, your ability to dream. That's your little experience of maya. And but that experience is the very stuff of this whole. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Non-existence doesn't exist. Even if people think that the Buddhists talk about non-existence, they don't. They talk about shunya, which is emptiness, not non-existence. Because non-existence isn't there. There's nothing we can say about it. It's conceptually useful to differentiate existence, non-existence, and that which lies in between that we call mitya. Existence, it always is. Non-existence, it never is. Mitya is that which depends for its being on the satsim. We use rope snake and clay pot as examples for that. Right.
They use the example of the void that represents.
The void, you shouldn't translate it as void. You should translate it as shunya, emptiness. They don't really use the word void. If somebody translates it as void, then it's... Yeah.
Do you think that when the mind, I mean, I know that the mind and consciousness are separate fundamentally, but do you think that when the mind is resting in the self?
Well, the mind and consciousness aren't separate fundamentally. There's a mithya relationship there. So the consciousness that the mind enjoys is consciousness. There's not a separate consciousness.
Right.
So the being and the existence that the mind enjoys is the Atma. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's not what you meant. You just meant the difference in terms of mithya.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So my question is, like, when the mind is identified with a jiva, when I'm identifying the self with the thought or perception,
yeah.
And then the jiva is created in that moment.
Well, as though, right? The jiva is just a product of ignorance. Yeah.
Right. So when I'm in that state, then that's a certain experience. And my question is, when I'm just myself, when I'm identified with consciousness, is there like a different quality of intelligence, would you say, that comes through the mind in that experience? That's different than if I'm identified with a concept of myself as a jiva and thinking and doing and all of that. But when I'm identified with consciousness and then, you know, thought comes out of that moment, do you know what I'm saying?
No.
The question is there a different kind of intelligence that comes through the mind when I'm identifying myself as Brahman versus as a jiva?
What do you mean by intelligence?
I'm not really sure exactly, but there's a quality of creativity that I've experienced before that comes through that feels different, like a different wavelength or a different...
Well, maybe if you look at it like this, like when the mind is just at home with the self, right? So that it's not lost in the samsara. There's no sense of, you know, I am my mind, or I am my body, or I am this. So the mind isn't lost in that raga dvesha, or it's not lost in rajas activity, or, you know, so it's sattvic, basically. Because there's nothing disturbing the mind. Then the mind has, naturally, is going to have a certain level of freedom, sense of freedom, and objectivity, and clarity. That belongs to the mind. Right, that freedom, objectivity, and clarity, relaxation, subtle, undisturbed, unbothered with a lot of worries and that type of thing. And so there's a freshness to that mind. Right? But in terms of Brahman, in terms of yourself hasn't changed. Yourself hasn't taken on a different quality or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the mind has. And for a person who has knowledge, your mind is just a lot more relaxed because the things that have caused it to become stressed and full of tension and worry and all of that, the mind doesn't think about things like in that same way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it enjoys more relaxation and peace. You know, even the way, say, if your mind's still working through you know, complexes and agitations. It takes a while for the mind to kind of root all of the problems out. But once you learn how to be with those problems, then also the mind has an objectivity and a peacefulness about it as it deals with those problems. So even in that way, the mind enjoys more relaxation because it's dealing with the problems, it's not identified with the problems. Or it's dealing with the traumas or the complexes or the hurts. You know, the power of the mind to overwhelm the buddhi becomes less and less. And as the power of the complexes to overwhelm the buddhi become less and less, the mind enjoys more relaxation.
And so in that relaxed state, then more subtle thoughts or creative, like different qualities of creativity come through in that state more so than if the mind's really concrete and stuck in samsara.
Probably if you're a creative person. But you know, if you are a creative person, then you have more access to your creativity when your mind is not, you know, bothered. You'll have more access to what is natural to you. You know, like say a person is not what somebody would call creative, maybe they're more intellectually creative. I mean, there's all kinds of different ways of being creative.
But that would be true if the mind was relaxed, you could go to knowledge or go to attaining something, right?
Yeah, it's a state of experience, you know. The one thing is that I do think that with knowledge your mind gains a relaxation that you don't really have without knowledge, because the problem is the problem is solved on a deeper level than you can solve it in samsara. And so because it's solved on a deeper level, there's more peace. You know, not that you can't maybe generate that peace once in a while through some sort of meditation, but it's not the same. It's not the same because even if you're generating that peace through meditation or whatever, it's still temporary. That's so much different. Yourself is not temporary. And so the whole relationship to samsara or even to your own mind or to the changing nature of your mind is, the mind relaxes around itself also in a way that it's hard to do if you don't have knowledge. So you still have to ask the world which can't solve the problem to solve the problem. And there's a part of you that knows that that's not going to work. It's all very high stress.
You think you'd see things more objectively too?
Yeah. Definitely.
Don't have an investment particularly.
The investment is so different, you know.
So when Swamiji's eating a mango, like he was in Australia, and thoroughly enjoying that mango, then so that's just like his mind, vritti, is a happy vritti. So it looks to me like Swamiji's really enjoying that mango, but really it's the taste is wonderful, and so the mind is happy, and all the while he knows he's Brahman. No, I don't mean it in a
no, but say he's totally enjoying the mango. The difference is he'll totally enjoy the mango, and if he doesn't have the mango, that's also fine.
Yeah,
you know it. And also, if you know yourself, you don't have to walk around saying, I'm Brahman, I'm Brahman, I'm Brahman, I'm Brahman. You are Brahman, right? It's just like an Ajnani doesn't have to walk around saying, I'm the body, I'm the body, I'm the body, I'm the body, I'm the body. They know they're the body. Now, everything is based on that understanding. And for Ajnani, once your knowledge is clear, everything that you do and think and feel is based on yourself.
Yeah.